Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Not only are the prospects of economic security in retirement more sketchy than ever, they are also a lot more complicated than the olden days when you worked 30 years for the same company and retired with a set amount and some health care coverage. We'll talk about the sweeping overhaul of public employee pensions in Ohio in a little bit, but joining us now to talk about the broader sweep of options these days is Diane Oakley. She's the executive director of the National Institute on Retirement Security. Welcome back to the show, Diane.
Hi, welcome back. I'm glad to be back with you folks in Ohio.
There's a lot of negative statistics that we can talk about. But you mentioned to me before we went on the air, one very positive thing. Ohio ranks number three in what?
Ohio has, for households over age 60, Ohio has the third highest percentage of households that have some form of defined benefit income, giving those households, you know, retirement security. And that's so critical because it enables those retirees, especially, you know, going back in 2009 and early 2010 with what was going on in the rest of the Ohio economy, to keep on spending. In essence, you know, they didn't have to make some tough decisions between can I have dinner tonight or can I take my medicine?
But the contrast to that is what their children have.
Exactly. You know, one of the things we're seeing, again, is if you were to go to a large Fortune 100 company, where before those companies predominantly had defined benefit plans covering their employees, today you'd probably have a 3 out of 10 chance of hitting an employer who would offer you a choice of a defined benefit plan. And in fact, only 1 out of those 10 would still have a real traditional pension. The other ones might be something more like a cash balance plan that are sort of a mix between a defined benefit and a defined contribution plan. And, you know, what's really interesting is the young workers coming into our workforce today are really different than their parents. In the paper in Washington, D.C., where I am, one of the lead articles is, you know, the muscle car that my generation grew up with, like a Pontiac GTO, is being replaced by an app for zip cars for kids in their 20s. You know, they realize they don't want it. They probably can't afford a big, hot kind of muscle car. At the same time, just yesterday, there was an article about a survey done by Charles Schwab, you know, the discount brokerage house. And what they said was that, you know, the kids between 18 and 34, those young people coming into our workforce, starting out, getting ready to think about, you know, working and maybe retiring in another 30 years, they were going to sit on the sideline in terms of taking market risk. And in fact, 28% of people in that age category say they actually want to pull investments out of the market that they might have made. So we've got a generation that in this, what's happened to them going through this Great Depression has really left them more risk averse, almost more like their great grandparents came out of the Depression. So I think that that means especially if they have a choice of a defined benefit plan at a new employer, that becomes a key attraction for them. They want grandma and grandpa's pension.
My guest is Diane Oakley. She's the executive director for the National Institute on Retirement Security. If you have any questions or comments for Diane, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Diane, just 1 in 3 workers under age 35 are eligible for a traditional pension plan, and even that is greatly reduced from what we think of as the pension plan and is not intended to fully support the worker in retirement. That's pretty much upside down from the past, and I'm wondering what sort of impact will this have on our economy going forward? Is it going to make that much of a difference, or will the 401ks and all the other tools out there make a difference?
Well, you know, we've done a lot of research. First of all, we've done research that looks at what retirees do when they have an income stream. And so we've looked at the payments coming from retirees both on a national level. We've looked at it from, you know, private sector, public sector, federal government. And in 2009, when the economy definitely needed a boost, we put $1 trillion in economic output into the economy by paying retirees' pensions. And in Ohio specifically, that force just from the public pensions alone was supporting 110,000 jobs. A lot of those jobs in food service, in retail, in helping people, you know, in terms of their housing and stuff like that. So that's a critical part of the component. And when you think about it, those 110,000 jobs represented about 2 percentage points of the total employment in Ohio. And at a time when, you know, unemployment at that point was 10%, that was critical to keep those people working and not lose those benefits. So there's a real economic impact when people spend benefits that they get in terms of keeping the rest of the economy going.
A writer for Time magazine called it the retirement Armageddon on the horizon because almost half of Americans say they aren't contributing to any retirement plan.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more on that in terms of, I don't know if I'd use Armageddon. I've been talking about baby boomers being on the verge of a retirement security crisis. When you look at the savings that American households have in retirement vehicles, 6 out of 10 households have less than 1 times their salary put away for retirement, and 3 out of 10 have nothing put away. And those are households that are between age 55 and 64. And you look at that and you say, how can those people expect to retire and have an income that's going to last them for maybe the next 20 years with those type of assets being saved? So we really are in a place where we've got a gap. Some economists have said it could be as much as $6 to $7 trillion of retirement savings that we need to have, that we don't have to make sure everybody has an adequate retirement. So, you know, we get concerned about what kind of an impact is all this going to have on public programs that support those who can't support themselves, you know, the safety net that's out there.
There's going to be a lot more people calling on that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And one of the things we found is that defined benefit plans, if you're in a defined benefit plan, you're 6 times more likely not to ever have to call on the federal government to help you out, be it through food stamps or any other type of assistance.
Diane Oakley, are even those of us with pensions really secure? I know the federal government passed the Pension Protection Act 6 years ago, and I wondered what made that necessary, for one thing. Is it really going to work to protect pensions going forward 15, 20 years down the road for the few people who do have them?
Well, you know, actually, the Pension Protection Act did some very good things for defined contribution plans. It introduced something called auto-enrollment, which said if you work for an employer, they can automatically enroll you in a plan. So you don't have that inertia that, you know, you keep on saying, well, I do it, but I don't want to get down to the HR office, or I can't figure out where to invest. It can automatically enroll you in the plan. And that's a good thing. But in terms of what it did for funding of pension plans, it actually took too stringent of a case, and it made the funding so much more severe and short-term that that's what's really driven corporate America away from offering defined benefit plans, is that the government sort of stepped in and sort of overcorrected for some mistakes. And I think it'd be important for us to look at that and revisit that. And there's some activity up on Capitol Hill to do that. And that's working its way through Congress. But, you know, still, we need to think about how do we get to retirement? How do we have an adequate income? How can we save as much as we can? And it's difficult in today's economy.
Big employers are looking for ways to morph their employees' 401ks into something more like traditional pensions by, I guess, shifting them to annuities. But even there, there's options. Why are employers starting to do that? Because they were really pushing those 401ks 10 years ago.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. There was a survey done by another consulting firm called Towers Watson. And their survey was looking at attraction and retention of employee benefits and what do people value most. And what was really clear is if you had a DB plan, and this is even surprising for workers under 40, if the employer offered them a DB plan, 63% of those employees said that was an important reason for them going to work for that employer. That's compared to 23% just 3 years ago. And when you look at employees saying what's important to them, if they're in a defined contribution plan, the retirement plan is acknowledged, but it's not at the top of their list. And so I think employers are starting to look and say, how can we make these plans provide some of the security that we have in defined benefit plans? And so they're starting to look at income options or offering people flexibility, the concept of mandatory enrollment. Some people are talking about, well, maybe there ought to be some type of mandatory annuitization or some type of move to make sure that employees have those choices and those options. And actually, the federal government has taken some action to ease some of the regulatory burden. So, for example, employees might be able to buy something called longevity insurance. You know, one of the things that's most difficult is, you know, how does anybody who's a normal person become their own actuary and figure out how long they're going to live and how long they're going to need to have their money?
Right.
And so there's some new products coming out called longevity insurance, which says, you know, in your 401k plan, what you could do is get benefits, you know, take benefits out of your account and know that you can exhaust it in so many years, let's say 20 years. And then if you live beyond 20 years, you just buy insurance for the risk that you're going to live that long. And it becomes a more cost-effective way to look at giving you control, but also taking care of your risk.
But isn't that expensive?
It's a little bit, it's definitely more expensive than doing it in a traditional plan. You know, NERS has done some research that shows, you know, if people are willing to have a traditional plan and offer that to their employees, they can do so at almost half the cost of what it would cost to provide the same benefit from a defined contribution plan. So we know these DB plans are cost efficient, and I think there's starting to be some ways that people are looking at, are there ways that we might be able to encourage more employers to offer something like this, make the risk more palatable for the employers? You know, and I think, you know, for example, what's going on in your state in Ohio clearly shows how much the employees and retirees value this. I know they've come together and they've been spending a good deal of time talking about reforms that, you know, really have, you know, hit people's pocketbooks. You know, it either says you have to work longer or, you know, you might not get the same amount of a cost of living increase. But basically, they then shore up those benefits and make them affordable. So I think, you know, one of the things we have to do is we certainly don't want to lose the good models we have of public sector pensions, because hopefully the private sector will start to come back and the circle will go back again.
Diane Oakley, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Diane Oakley, she's Executive Director for the National Institute on Retirement Security. Coming up, Ohio public employees and what sort of securities they have in store for them coming down the line. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Watch an investigation into the collapsing Pacific salmon population. Salmon are now conceived in laboratories, raised in tanks, driven in trucks, and farmed in pens. Watch Salmon Running the Gauntlet, Wednesday night at 8 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
62 degrees in downtown Columbus, cloudy skies today, maybe a little sunshine. There's also an increasing chance of rain this afternoon, a high of 74. Clouds tonight, a low of 55. Sunshine tomorrow, a high of 81. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
About 2 weeks ago, a sweeping overhaul of public employee pensions was proposed in the Ohio Senate. And by last week, the Senate had voted out a version of that. The legislation now heads to the Ohio House, where they are not as quick at the switch, apparently. The changes affect Ohio's five public retirement systems. It covers 1.7 million workers, retirees, and beneficiaries. Somebody you know is probably, look to your left, look to your right, somebody you know is probably involved in this. Joining us now to talk about that is Laura Bischoff. She's a State House reporter for the Dayton Daily News. Welcome to the show, Laura.
Hello, WOSU listeners.
The Public Employee Retirement Fund managers pitched their reform plans 3 years ago. What has taken lawmakers so long? Have they been putting their time to good use?
Well, they've been, you know, of course, busy on other things like the budget and Senate Bill 5 and other you know, issues and topics. In that interim, the pension systems have been pretty much begging the lawmakers to act, that they really want these changes. And the pension systems have been going out and kind of selling it to their membership to say, because these are hard pills to swallow, and they're saying, look, we have to do this for the long-term health of the plans. But the lawmakers in the House seem to be a little bit not quite as anxious to move on it as the Senate. Of course, you know, they're all going back to campaign in their districts, and maybe they don't want to have to campaign in the face of, by the way, we're going to make you work longer and accept a lesser benefit in the end, and telling retirees that you may have to accept a lower cost of living allowance.
Or conversely, to some of their constituents, they maybe didn't go far enough.
Oh, well, you know, it's interesting. You know, we were talking before the show started, and I think that if Senate Bill 5, the collective bargaining reform referendum, if that had gone a different way, if the voters had said, you know, go ahead, we want to reduce worker pay and benefits and rights, then I think that would have kind of emboldened lawmakers, to the fiscal conservatives in particular, to make even more dramatic changes to the pension systems. And Diane was talking earlier about defined benefits versus defined contribution plans. Ohio has a defined benefit plan for its employees, and basically that means that you are guaranteed a certain amount of money at the end of your career based on how many years you put in and what your salary was and some other factors. A defined contribution plan is more like a 401k, where you put a certain amount of money in, a defined contribution amount each year, and at the end of your career, whatever it's worth, that's what you get. And there's no guarantee that it's going to be, you know, X, Y, or Z amount.
But with a defined pension, public employees do contribute to that.
Yes, exactly.
As opposed to maybe a private sector employer that just uses it as a perk.
Right. And actually, the employees pay, you know, usually like 10%. And those contribution rates are going to go up, particularly, I think, for state teachers and for police and fire. They're going to go up to I think police and fire is going to go up to 12.5%. State teachers eventually, the teachers may be paying as much as 14%. So the contribution rates are going to go up. The taxpayer contributions are not going to go up. They're already pretty high, and they're going to be held in place.
My guest is Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. We're talking about the public employees retirement systems, pension plans. They're up for reform. The Senate's passed a sweeping reform measure. The House is not so quick to work on that yet. They want to look at a study that's supposed to be coming out this summer. In the meantime, if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. So what's driving the need for the change? They've been out, they've been talking to the memberships, and you're right, absolutely, the unions themselves are saying, let's go, let's get this done, let's swallow this pill. But how have they convinced them? What is driving the need for change?
Well, in Ohio, there's a requirement that it's called like the 30-year requirement. And it basically says that the systems have to have enough money coming in to meet their liabilities over the next 30 years. It's like being able to pay your mortgage. And a couple of the systems, Highway Patrol, state teachers, and police and fire, are not in that 30-year requirement. Their liabilities are much bigger than the money coming in. So the liabilities is one thing. The longevity, people are living a lot longer. Sometimes some of these systems, their parameters were set up in the 1940s when the mortality tables were a lot different. And then the stock market losses in 2008, even though they've rebounded, that was a big blow to the pension systems.
There are also what some people would consider lavish perks, and one of them is the spike. That public employees are able to use under certain circumstances. Can you give us an example of what that spike option is and why and when people use it?
Sure. For example, in OPERS, which covers general employees, they identified, I think, 772 what they call egregious spikers. And these are people who, through promotions or job switches at the end of their term, or just ridiculous amounts of overtime, they've been able to increase their salary, and their pension is based on the final your final average salary of your highest 3 years. Okay, so if you can spike 3 years worth of salary, that's what your pension's based on, even if you made hardly anything. This is particularly true with township trustees. Like, township trustees might only make a couple grand
a year,
mm-hmm. right? And then they go to the legislature and they make $62,000. Well, then their pension is based on $62,000 annual salary
over the course of 20 years.
Over the course of 20 years, even though they spent 17 years as a township trustee, and so it's actuarially it's out of balance, and it's interesting because it's something that the lawmakers tend to take advantage of. You might recall that Joyce Beatty was the House Minority Leader in the Ohio House, and she right. so as the Minority Leader, I think she probably made about $75,000 a year. And then Gordon Gee hired her as one of his Senior Vice Presidents for Outreach. And so for the last 3 years before she won before she got into the race for Congress, she made I think $340,000. So her pension will be based on $340,000 instead of $75,000. Or the lesser amounts. She has had a number of public jobs over the years.
Not bad.
If you can get. So they did. So OPERS put in like this brilliant little mathematical calculation to tamp down on spiking, so that you can't see. You can still have like a normal progression in your career, and not be penalized for that. But you can't go 10 times higher on a salary than what you've had. Over the course of your career.
Now, I mean, when they instituted that, has that been around for a long time, the spike, or and why wasn't that being figured into the bottom line? Has it really cost public employee retirement systems that much money?
Well, again, the lawmakers are the ones that write the rules. Pension in Ohio, the pension systems, this stuff isn't negotiated through union contracts. It's all done through the law, and the lawmakers are in OPERS. So over the years, there have been some things put in there that I think serve the self-interest of the lawmakers, and spiking is one of them. They're also allowed to buy time at a discount, which is another thing that OPERS is trying to clear up.
So is there every expectation, though, that then something like the spike will be tamped down?
Well, it's in the bill. It's in the bills
now, but it still has to go through the House,
right? It still has to go through the House. So, you know, who knows what the final product will be and when it'll come out.
So I mentioned the consultant's report that's due this summer, and that's what the House says they're waiting for. But will they actually be ready to vote when they return in November after the election? And is this the first year of the two-year biennium or the second year?
We're at the tail end of the session.
So if they don't do it in November, they'd have to reintroduce it.
Right. And okay. It would just be – and the other thing is the systems have calculated that the longer they wait to make these changes, they're losing collectively $2 million a year or a day in savings that they could be making.
Okay? So how much have they lost in the last 3 years, and that's times 900 or 1,000 days?
It's a lot of money. When you ask Tom Niehaus, well, why didn't you act on this earlier? He's like, I'm embarrassed. But he didn't, mm-hmm. you know, beyond that, there's not much of an answer. You know, these are really big systems. There's 1.7 million retirees, active workers, and people who used to be government workers who are vested in the systems, and they have collectively like $165 billion in investments. These are, in Ohio, this is a really big deal. Like you said, look to your left, look to your right. You'll find public workers pretty much everywhere you turn.
So those billions, to what extent did the 2008 market downturn affect them?
Oh, it was really big, and it's been, it's harder to recover from that. And it's affected pension systems all across the country, as you can imagine. Oh, one point I wanted to make is in Ohio, I went to a reporting fellowship out in Arizona last year on specifically on pension public pension systems. And what I took away from that, which I didn't know before, is that Ohio has a reputation as being very well run for its public pension systems. And you might not think that because you keep hearing about how they're underwater and they have to have these changes and all this stuff. But it's really the changes that Ohio needs are minor when you look at other states. More than 40 states have already done some sort of pension reform over the last couple of years. California, Pennsylvania, and Illinois are now going through more dramatic pension reforms. But Ohio has been pretty good about managing things through the years. They've never taken what's called the pension holiday, where basically they skip the employer contribution for that year or for that month or what have you. And those kind of shenanigans, which have happened in other states, can really really put a pension system underwater quickly.
Because they still have to pay out the pension.
Right, because it's a guaranteed benefit. They promised that it's a contractual. Another big thing that's really hanging out there is what are they going to do with health care? A lot of the pension systems are barely treading water to provide health care for their retirees. Some of these folks, they retired in their late 50s, and they have, 8 years to go until they're eligible for Medicare. And so they have been buying health care through the funds. The funds have required them to pay bigger co-pays, bigger premiums, significantly more than what they had in the past. But they're going to, they're quickly running out of money for those. And one of the reasons why OPRS wants, which is the biggest pension system, one of the reasons why they want these changes done this year is because if it doesn't happen by the end of this legislative session, they're going to have to start making preparations for slashing their health care spending from $1.5 billion a year down to like $500,000. Or I'm sorry, $500 million.
By two-thirds then.
Right.
My guest is Laura Bischoff, correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. We're talking about the sweeping overhaul of public employee pensions proposed in the Ohio Senate, passed in the Ohio Senate last week. It's before the Ohio House now. Probably won't get acted on until next November. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. The consultant's report that's due this summer, that's what the House says they're waiting for. What are they supposed to learn from that they don't already know?
Well, in Ohio, we have what's called the Ohio Retirement Study Council. It's a bipartisan group of lawmakers and members of the public. And basically, they're like a backstop, and they double-check things that the pension funds want to do and double-check things that the lawmakers want to do and, kind of make sure everything's on the up and up. And the Ohio Retirement Study Council voted, I think last September or so, that they wanted to have another actuarial firm come in and double check the numbers that the pension funds have been saying, like these are the fixes that we need, and this will put us within our 30-year requirement, and it'll it'll kind of right our ship. And the ORSC wanted to hire another firm just to kind of double check those numbers, and so that's what they're waiting on. And that's I think it's due probably sometime in July it'll come out.
But nobody will be around to read it.
Well, I think some of the lawmakers, particularly on the ORSC, will be reading it over the summer. And there's a chance they might come back in September or so and act on this stuff. But I'm thinking more likely it'll happen after the election in November.
We mentioned the spike. Are there any other sorts of perks that are out there that are going to change?
Well, like I said, buying time at a discount is something. That's where the lawmakers can purchase time in the system at less than the actuarial cost, and I believe that's going to be removed. There's probably a couple other little tweaks and twists and turns in there that they've that they're trying to clean up. I think it's all in there.
Will it affect these kinds of changes? Will they affect people in the system now, or will people be grandfathered in? In other words, people who are already in PERS, they'll still be able to spike, or they'll still be able to buy years?
I'm not sure how they're working this. I think the spiking stuff is going to take effect right away, the anti-spiking measures. But some of the other changes, like the age and eligibility rules, people will have to work a little bit longer till they're a little older, put in more years before they're eligible to retire. And rather than, I think they're going to have kind of like a stair step so that people who are very close to retirement won't have to all of a sudden have to put in another 5 years. So they're going to kind of gradually get people into this thing. I think police and fire, I believe that that some of their changes are only impacting new hires. So, the guys who are the guys and gals who are already in the system won't have as they won't be facing some of these changes.
Now, public employee retirement systems, they've said they're okay with this. The rank and file are okay with it. But I was wondering about police and fire because they have a different sort of challenge in attracting people to those kinds of dangerous sorts of jobs. Are they concerned about that with these kinds of benefits being cut?
I've heard from a number of police officers and firefighters who say, this is not a young person's job. Right now, they're allowed to retire at age 48. This eventually would boost them up to age 52. If you look back, though, within the changes that have been kind of put through the pension systems over the years, the retirement age used to be 54 or 52, then it moved down to 50. So they've kind of gradually moved that.
And all that
needle.
Was at the legislative level, though, as you said.
Right.
Those kind of changes were done.
Right. Well, of course, the police and fire unions and the rest of them, they lobby the legislature just like any other group to try to get changes that they think are necessary and important. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see how the police and the firefighters, if this becomes, a disincentive for somebody to join that as a career and to think, well, I got to work till I'm 52. Instead of 48, I won't be able to retire and then start a second career. We'll see. I still think those are pretty good jobs. People, they like the public service. They like helping people. They like, they like the work. So I think that there'll still be a supply of people who will want to do it.
Well, Laura, thanks for joining us today to tell us about it.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Bischoff, she's a correspondent for the Dayton Daily News. We've been talking about public employee retirement system changes in the state of Ohio. There's an overhaul. Just left the Ohio Senate. It's headed to the Ohio House. Probably act on it next November. We'll probably be talking about it again. When we return, we're going to look at generally what are the options out there these days, and is it as complicated as it looks? We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the U.S. has slapped big tariffs on Chinese solar panels. So what do we need more, to go green or buy American? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point is this afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. And stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. It's Tech Tuesday and a discussion of the ups and downs of Facebook stock. That and more during Tech Tuesday from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. And for the latest from All Sides with Ann Fisher, be sure to visit our website anytime at WOSU.org/allsides. From the website, you can listen and watch the show live weekdays from 10 until noon. Also, be sure to explore the archive, which includes audio and video of every show. That's WOSU.org/allsides. Clouds and a little bit of sunshine today, a high of 74. There is a chance of rain later today. Cloudy skies for tonight, a low of 55 degrees. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high of 81. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News.
There are lots of options out there for consumers of financial tools intended to buoy them in retirement. Joining us now to talk about some of those options and the pros and cons is Greg Doherty. He's executive editor of Consumer Reports. He also writes the Retirement Guy column for Consumer Reports. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Oh, thank you, Ann.
I want to go all the way back to last summer. You wrote about pension payout options. And for those among us who are still lucky enough to actually get a a defined pension. What are the options once you get it?
Well, there's a couple of ways to handle that money. I mean, one is to take it as a lump sum and then, you know, try to deal with it from there, either in terms of spending it down or living off the dividends and interest and so forth of it, or to try to buy an annuity, which is, you know, something an insurance company will sell you that will pay you, a certain amount of income for the rest of your life.
Is that something you make at the outset? Or it's when you retire that you're able to make that choice?
Typically, you make that decision when you move into retirement with your employer. And you also have some other decisions to make, such as, you know, if you have a spouse, the default is that it's called a joint and survivor annuity, which means that it's your spouse will continue to get something if you happen to die first.
The same column said to focus on goals. And I was wondering, what sort of questions did you ask yourself to get to those goals? Because sometimes when you're 10, 15, 20 years away from retirement, it's really hard to imagine, what am I going to want to live like?
Right, exactly. I mean, so we recommend that people, first of all, try to get a handle on their expenses in retirement. And this can be kind of difficult to do if you're many, many years from retirement. But if you're, you know, closing in on, if you're, say, 10 years out, you might be able to think it through. So, some of your expenses will be lower if you aren't commuting to a job every day, for example. Others might be higher, you know, travel. If you've been wanting to travel more, you might be, dining out more. You certainly, if you don't take another job in retirement, you probably have more time during the day, so you might find yourself at the mall spending more money. So, if you can get a handle on what your spending is likely to be, then you can look at the income that you're likely to have and just see how the two match up.
There is something called pension maximization, and one of the columns recommends that people steer clear of that. What is a pension maximization, and why steer clear of it?
I'm not familiar with that term. Okay. I must say, what do they mean by that?
I don't know. They never really actually explain. But all right, so annuities, they're a component of pension plans, and you said there's three basic types. How do you know which annuity is right for you if you're going to go that direction?
Well, annuities are kind of a tricky product in some ways. We would urge people to steer clear of what are called variable annuities, in large part because the expenses on them are quite high. An immediate annuity is the sort of annuity that starts paying you an income, you know, right away. So that's something you would buy with a chunk of retirement money, and it will pay you, something for as long as you live. Now, even those you have to be very careful with. You need to understand the, interest rate assumptions behind them. You need to consider inflation protection. You know, if you retire at, 62 or 65 or something like that and live for another 30, 35 years, which is not at all uncommon, inflation can whittle that down to, virtually nothing over time. So, you have to sort of understand all those assumptions.
My guest is Greg Daugherty. He's executive editor of Consumer Reports. If you have a question or comment for him about retirement options, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. A Chicago Tribune column I read earlier this month, it warned of the IRA tax trap. What's the trap and how can it be avoided? Why is it a trap? There's a tax when you cash it out, right?
Right. Your IRA, money in there is taxed as ordinary income. So you've got to be aware of that. And for many people, certainly a trap is if you don't consider the tax burden on it. If you simply take that money out, you're going to have to find money someplace to pay that taxes. And if you take it out of your IRA, you've depleted an asset that's earning money tax deferred in the meantime. So the best thing would be to have some other money to pay that tax bill when the time comes.
A Reuters story last August warned that 401ks will fall short for most Americans. Is that because they're poorly funded, poorly managed, or never intended to bear the brunt in the first place?
You know, I think it's a combination of all of those. I mean, the 401k gets sort of a bad rap because it, you know, a lot of people are headed into retirement with what looks like not enough money. But, you know, when 401ks began, they were to supplement traditional pensions, which many people, in fact, most workers had at that time. This is in the 1970s and into the early 80s. And in the meantime, you know, a lot of traditional pensions have gone away, and people are just, you know, all they have left is the 401k. There's exceptions. I mean, a lot of, you know, state and other government workers still have traditional pensions, although new hires are much less likely to be offered one. And some people at big corporations still have traditional pensions, too. But for many people, the 401k is all they've got. And, you know, that argues for putting as much money as you possibly can into it. I mean, if you can afford to, put the maximum in, which I believe this year is 17,000 for people who are $17,000 for people who are under 50, and there's what they call a catch-up provision that allows people who are over 50 to put another $5,500 in. So, you know, if you can do that, that's a great thing to do. And when the time comes, you'll have more money in that 401k if it's you know, you're depending on that for your, you know, as a major chunk of your support.
We have an email from Steve. He writes, "What changes have been made or considered with disability retirement eligibility? Is that something people should be worried about?"
You know, I don't know what changes have been made there. I mean, I think disability is something in general that people need to be worried about, or at least consider. I mean, you can get disability insurance through an employer. Typically, is the cheapest way to get it. You can also buy it on the open market, although it gets pretty expensive there. But you know, I think people do have to consider in general what might happen if you had to retire sooner than planned. I mean, a lot of us have the notion that we'll just keep working. And, you know, and now and then, unfortunately, something will happen to your health or to some other aspect of your life that requires you to retire sooner. So, you know, we urge people to have a couple of scenarios. You've got the ideal scenario that everything works out fine and you retire when you want to. And then there's the other scenario that you have to retire sooner than anticipated, and you need to kind of look at what your income would be at that point, and would you be able to support yourself?
In February, you wrote about 7 easy ways to mess up retirement. Mm-hmm. If we can get to all 7, great. But first, I wanted to talk to you about the issue of risk. It was noted by one of your sources that he sees a sudden aversion to risk among many new retirees. And I'm thinking, well, that's what a lot of people are told to become, to change the makeup of their investment tools as they near retirement to assure
right.
the incomes. It that's what you're told to do.
Right. And a lot of, well, I think, you know, people do need to begin to scale back on their stock exposure in many cases as they near retirement. But, you know, many people are just feel so burned by the stock market that many young people even are avoiding it altogether. You know, the stock market still is, you know, we believe the best place for, you know, some growth potential in the years to come. And it's going to have its ups and downs. And it's been, you know, scarily volatile in the last year or so. It's nothing to, you know, for it to go up, you know, 100 and some points or down 200 some points in the course of a day now. And that can be kind of jarring. But still, it does seem to have the best prospect for staying ahead of inflation and growing over time. So it's, you know, if it scares you too much, you know, try to, you know, still have some kind of reasonable exposure to stocks. And if necessary, you know, don't open your statement too often and worry about it too much. I mean, take a long-term perspective. The stock market's going to go up and down, but over time, historically, it has tended to go up.
Back to the 7 easy ways to mess up retirement. We've already kind of talked about not having a plan and then having alternative plans as well. Another one is not knowing what you've got.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, you know, as we go through life, we accumulate various things, you know, maybe some employer stock from some place we used to work. And, you know, some people leave 401ks behind at old employers and, you know, barely remember they have them. You know, savings bonds you might have gotten for your birthday years ago and those kinds of things. So I think it makes sense to, you know, take an inventory just to see what all you have. Most people are pleasantly surprised. Usually we have a little more than we anticipated.
I guess you're talking about inheritance or what?
Well, there's always that possibility too. Although I wouldn't count on it. But mm-hmm. You know, most of us have money in different places. I mean, for example, you may have money in a 529 plan for a for a child, you may not have spent all of it if you're at all lucky. So that money may still be there. Other kinds of stocks and things you've picked up over the years, or as you say, inherited. So, I think if you sit down and try to say, okay, I've got my 401k, I know how much is in that from the statement on that, but what else have I got that I might turn into an asset when I retire? And of course, home equity is another part of that, the value of your home. But we urge people to be very cautious there, because we've seen that, home prices don't always go up. And of course, you're going to need a place to live in retirement. So you can't necessarily count on, even if you do sell and downsize, you can't count on reaping all that money and investing it.
You did another column a year ago, maybe you don't remember it, but you talked about buying versus renting in retirement.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's a very interesting question. When you do the math, sometimes it makes sense to rent rather than buy in retirement. And it also, of course, gives you the freedom to, explore different places, which a lot of people like to do in retirement. So, even if you've been a homeowner, for most of your adult life, you might want to, look at renting versus buying. Would it make sense to, rather than make a substantial down payment on a house, invest that money and rent instead, at least for a while. So we urge people to take a look at it. They may decide for a bunch of reasons they'd still rather own, because there's something about owning a home that people take great pride in. But don't dismiss renting right out of the out of the box.
We've all heard the warning to not have a mortgage in retirement, to have that debt paid off.
Yeah, I think you can look at that a couple of different ways. I mean, one is, at a low interest rate, if your money's invested elsewhere, it could actually make financial sense to keep a mortgage. You might come out ahead. We find, though, we do an annual survey of retirees every year, and we find that people really like having that mortgage paid off. There's a sort of peace of mind of not, and just not having the bother of that big bill hanging over your head all the time. So, I think if only for psychological reasons, I think it makes sense to pay a mortgage off. You can argue the financial thing both ways.
One of our listeners wanted you to repeat what you had said about annuity preference.
Well, I think, in looking at annuities, our preference is, if you're going to consider an annuity, it probably ought to be what's called an immediate annuity. That's the kind, again, that pays you immediately once you give an insurance company some money, and then they start paying you every month for the rest of your life. Variable annuities are much trickier in terms of their costs and so forth, and they are taxed as ordinary income when the money comes out, unlike if you invest in stocks and bonds and things that are taxed these days at a more favorable rate. So and in choosing an annuity, I think I would, unless I were personally an expert on it, is try to get some help, get a fee-only financial planner or somebody who has no stake in selling you an annuity to look at some different ones from different companies and telling you what really to expect and what you'll really be paying in the way of fees and that kind of thing.
What about young people with debt? Should they pay off the debt, say, from student loans before investing in retirement, or what?
Yeah, that does often make sense to retire those debts. In an ideal world, you could do both, but I think getting rid of those debts, especially if it's at a high interest rate, I think I would get rid of that first. And the other thing we urge people to consider, when they're starting out, before they put money in a retirement plan necessarily, is you want to have some kind of little emergency fund to tide you over if you. Your car breaks down, or if something or other happens, your dog gets sick. You need some cash,
and
so don't tie up all your cash in a 401k, because it's harder to get it out. You can, in hardships, get money out. You can borrow against it in some instances, but that becomes complicated and all the rest. So have a little money tucked away someplace where you can get at it. But then really do turn your attention to your retirement plan, especially when you're younger. I mean, putting money in there, the money you put in there early grows, has the potential for such growth over time that, if you miss that opportunity, it's much harder to catch up later in life.
Well, speaking of young people in debt, you wrote a column in January about your retirement versus your kids and how much financial support you owe your adult children. It's become more of a problem because of the economic downturn.
Yeah, it has indeed. I mean, it's really rough on many families now. I mean, the best advice, and it's heartless as it sounds, is that parents really need to try to focus on their retirement first. I mean, that doesn't mean, you know, don't return your kids' phone calls or something, but it does mean that, you know, try to get that squared away. I mean, one reason is you don't want to be a burden on your kids later in life. And, you know, we will come out of this economic crisis eventually, but, you know, it'd be good for you to come out of it with your retirement plans in reasonably good shape. And so, you know, we think people, you know, you, by all means, help your kids to the extent you can, but, you know, certainly try not to go into debt in order to do so, and try not to deplete your retirement savings in order to do so. And, you know, just, you know, bear in mind that, you know, in terms of the long term, you really are doing your kids a favor by getting your own financial house in order.
And to what extent is it helpful to tell your kids and explain to them what your retirement benefits are and how you are living?
I think it is worth doing that. I think for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, it's good. It's instructive to them in planning their own lives. And they'll also understand that, you know, there are constraints and limits that, you know, you as a parent are under. And, you know, and anything like that, I think, is, you know, is helpful to, you know, families to sort of work this stuff out together.
Well, Greg Daugherty, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Well, Ann, thank you so much.
Greg Daugherty, he's executive editor of Consumer Reports. We've been talking about retirement options today. Earlier, we talked about the big state employee, the public pension plan that's going to be reformed, five plans that are going to be reformed over the next probably 6 or 7 months. For more information on that, you can go to our website at WOSU.org, and we'll have a link there for you. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.